content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we will finish the article we started last week called Trading Places by Joe Marchant. In Egyptian's eastern desert, wondrous new finds from the ancient port of Berenike are challenging old ideas about the makings of the modern world. Essentially, they're finding there was a lot more trade between the East and the Roman Empire than previously thought. We'll pick up a little bit before we ended last week. No port can operate alone. To understand the significance of this outpost, says Matthew Cobb, an ancient historian at the University of Wales, Trinity St. David, it's critical to look across the sea to uncover what he calls an intricate web of overlapping connections. Off the coast of what is now Yemen, for example, is a rocky island called Socotra, mentioned in the Periplus as a stopping point for ships passing between the Indian Ocean and the Red Sea. Socotra's cliffs boast a deep cave with hundreds of inscribed messages, graffiti left by sailors written in South Arabian, Ethiopian, Palmyrene, Bactrian, and Greek scripts and languages. In 2019, Strouch analyzed inscriptions from more than 100 Indian visitors written between the 2nd and 5th centuries AD, concluding that a number of sailors and ship captains hailed from Gujarat on India's northwestern coast. And then there's Patanam on India's southern Kerala coast. Today, a quiet palm-shaded village that Siddhobotham describes as Berenike's sister site. Archaeologists believe this was once the great port of Muziris, described in literary sources such as a Tamil epic poem from around the 2nd century AD, which told how Greek traders exchanged their gold for Indian pepper. In 2006, Indian researchers, led by P.J. Charian of the PAMA, Institute for the Advancement of Transdisciplinary Archaeological Sciences in Kerala, began excavations at Patanam and have since found a wharf area, a 20-foot-long wooden canoe apparently used to ferry goods to ships anchored in deep water, and thousands of pottery shards from the Mediterranean, amphoras used to transport wine, olive oil, and garum, a beloved Roman fish sauce. They've also unearthed spindle whorls and gaming counters, fragments of marble, iron, copper, and gold, nearly 100,000 glass beads, and thousands more of semi-precious stone. And in 2020, a rare seal ring made of banded agate, an Indian gemstone, yet carved with an elegant Egyptian sphinx. Augustus Caesar wore one just like it early in his political career. The ring hints at the presence of Greco-Roman craftsmen working with local gems. As on the Egyptian side, Charian says, the trade route didn't end at Muziris, but would have continued across land and sea to India's east coast and on to China. From his perspective, it was Muziris, not Berenike, that formed the junction between east and west, the central hub that connected the known world. And as archaeologists are busy analyzing the growing material finds, other scholars are reassessing literary sources to better evaluate the economic impacts of these intercontinental networks. They already knew that trade was robust in the early 1st century AD, before trade reached its peak. The Greek geographer Strabo described eastbound fleets of more than 100 merchant ships. Another key source, a contract known as the Muziris Papyrus, dating from the 2nd century, is more specific, describing a loan between an Alexandria-based businessman and a merchant for a return voyage to Muziris. On the reverse side, the text details the cargo of a ship called the Hermopolon, which included 140 tons of pepper, 80 boxes of nard, an aromatic oil used for perfumes, medicines, and rituals, and around 4 tons of ivory. Its value, after payment of the Roman Empire's 25% import tax, was nearly 7 million sesterces, which scholars have calculated was easily enough to buy a luxury estate in central Italy, or if you prefer, to pay 40,000 stonecutters for a year. That translates into some vast fortunes. Meanwhile, Rome's emperors were filling their own coffers. In 2014, the independent historian and author Raoul McLaughlin used sources including the Musiris Papyrus to estimate that by the 1st century AD, the Roman tax revenues from Indian Ocean trade may have generated as much as one-third of the empire's total income. Cobb puts the figure lower, perhaps at 10 or 15%, but he agrees that the volume of such goods would have likely dwarfed those transported along the Silk Road, the network of overland routes that connected China with Rome, which have received much more scholarly and public attention. Just think of the number of camel or donkey loads you would need, he says, to transport the several hundred tons of cargo that could fit onto just one ship. The huge incomes from these maritime connections would have been vital for supporting Rome's territories and conquests across an empire that stretched from Hadrian's Wall at the border with Scotland to the waters of the Persian Gulf. And just as global trade today impacts more than economics, the cultural influences were profound too. For instance, historians have long thought about Roman trade with the East in terms of luxury items enjoyed by a small number of Roman elites. Pliny mentions a rock crystal ladle worth 150,000 sesterces, for example, and an opal ring that cost 2 million sesterces. But what Berenike emphatically drives home, Sittabotham says, is that trade among the Mediterranean world, Asia, Arabia, and Africa, just exploded, with land and maritime routes complementing each other. There was a global economy, such as they knew the globe back then. It's not just being used by the tiny elite. By the end of the 1st century, Eastern herbs, spices, clothing, and even animals would have changed ordinary people's lives. From the tigers, rhinoceroses, and wild boars brought for gladiatorial shows to frankincense and myrrh, widely used as perfumes, as medicines, and in religious rituals. And black pepper shipped across the Indian Ocean would have radically shifted the tastescape, as Kopp puts it, of the Western world. In a Roman cookbook known as Apicius, for example, possibly compiled in the 1st century AD, pepper is called for in 349 out of 468 recipes, from mulled wine to roast pork. Elites didn't consume huge quantities of Eastern goods. At the funeral of Nero's wife Poppaea, the emperor reportedly burned more incense than Arabia could produce in a year, but more modest amounts were within reach of even relatively low-status individuals in remote regions. A tablet dating from the 2nd century AD, found at the relatively remote Roman fort of Vindolanda in northern England, records an ordinary soldier's order for 2 denarii, 8 sesterces worth of pepper. The cumulative effect, Cobb suggests, would have been to give people across the empire a safe sense of living in a much larger world that stretched far beyond Roman realms. What is now coming out of Berenike, however, suggests cultural exchange of a wholly unexpected kind. I'll never forget the day, Sittabotham says. It was January 18th, 2022, and he was in the excavation house examining some small finds when a worker ran in with a note saying that something had been found in the temple courtyard. He hurried over to find the trench supervisor, Mariana Castro, grinning widely and hiding something behind her back. Several pieces of carved marble, which fit together into an exquisite haloed head. With its youthful beatific expression, elongated ears, and a top knot of tight curls, it could only be Buddha. The only such find from antiquity anywhere west of Afghanistan. 2 years later, the archaeologists are still trying to make sense of it. In the team's shared office, Bergman flips through photographs of the carved head on her laptop screen. The sculpture itself was quickly removed for safekeeping by Egyptian authorities, who have said they plan to display it in a museum in the northern Egyptian city of Ismailia. From examining photographs, The team is confident the head belongs to a robed, marbled body found in 2018, making a statue a little under 28 inches tall. The figure is carved from white marble quarried from the island of Prokonissos, near present-day Istanbul, and it doesn't look like any Buddha found before or since. It's clearly a Buddha because of the gestures and the way the garments are worn, Bergman says, referring to the right hand raised in reassurance and the left hand holding at the robe. But it does not look Indian at all. The drilled spiral hair, which Bergman has dubbed tortellini curls, appears to be influenced by a hairstyle fashionable with elite Roman women up to around AD 140. Likewise, the triangular sun rays added to the halo appear more in keeping with Mediterranean sun god traditions than with conventional Buddhas. Remarkably, the team has also found pieces of other smaller Buddhas made from local stone. Bergman suggests they were all carved here by Greco-Roman sculptors, some of whom may have traveled from Alexandria. Perhaps they were given models to copy, possibly little bronze or wooden figurines brought over on ships, and they filled in the details using their own knowledge and expertise. At the time, in the early centuries AD, the Indian subcontinent was dominated by three powerful dynasties. The Kushan Empire ruled the north, including Gandhara, a region covering areas of present-day Pakistan and Afghanistan. The Western Kshatrapas controlled western India, including what's now Gujarat, with the Satavahanas prevailed in the south. Scholars aren't sure precisely where the model for the Berenike Buddha originates from, but Bergman sees the closest parallels in artistic style with 2nd century AD Buddhas from Gandhara. The Sanskrit inscription, which was found near the Buddha's head barely half an hour later, seems to have a different origin. It dates to AD 249, more than a century later, and has its closest parallels in texts from Gujarat. It too appears to have been carved at Berenike, however, uniquely combining Eastern and Western features. It's the first Buddhist inscription that we find in Egypt, Strouch says. The first inscription in Sanskrit. It's the only one with a Roman emperor mentioned. The carved triad is also unprecedented. Bhandari, of the Ashmolean Museum, identifies the figure as early Indic deities. Balarama, holding a plow, Vasudeva, who later became Krishna with a wheel and a club, and the goddess Ekanamasa. Closest comparisons he can find are on coins from Mathura in northern India, a region associated with the Kushan dynasty. But the Berenike figures are carved from local stone and are surrounded by a typically Greco-Roman decorative arch. Bhandari tentatively dates the stele to between AD 50 and 150. It's absolutely stunning that intimate knowledge of Indian iconography seems to be available in Berenike at this time, he says. Lugovaya, the papyrologist from Germany, points out just how unexpected it was to discover such items in the Isis temple. It's like having an Indian sanctuary in the Vatican, she says. It takes cultural exchange to a different level than we have observed anywhere else. Caper, the Egyptologist, wonders how worshippers of local cults would have responded to the statues, noting that followers of polytheistic religions were generally welcoming of new faiths. We know that Greeks and Romans tried to recognize their own gods and the Egyptian gods, he says. They must have done that with the Buddha. It's completely fascinating. A handful of objects related to ancient Indian religions have previously been found in the Roman world, most notably an ivory statuette of a Yakshi fertility spirit, dated to the 1st century AD, unearthed at Pompeii. But the Berenike finds are not just traded objects that have been picked up from one place and dropped at another, Bhandari says. That's what sets these things apart. These locally made items show that people must have been traveling from India and bringing their traditions, religious beliefs, and languages with them. We knew they were bringing in Indian goods, Ast says. We didn't know they were living their lives here, pursuing their cults and rituals. As recently as 2019, Strouch published an article arguing that there was no material evidence for Buddhist communities in the ancient West. Now he has torn up that conclusion. There must have been a community of Indians not just passing through, but living and worshiping in Berenike, he says. This is a social act. They want to have a presence here. That presence, he goes on, may help to explain how Latin and Greek authors who mention Buddhism in their texts, such as the 2nd century AD Christian theologian Clement of Alexandria, learned about the Eastern faith. Scholars have occasionally suggested that Buddhism influenced aspects of early Christianity from the practices of early Christian monasteries in Egypt to similarities between the life stories of Buddha and Jesus Christ, although most researchers emphasize that there is little evidence for direct links. Even accounting for the new finds, Bondari says, it would be a bit of a jump to assume significant direct influence. Nevertheless, the finds show that these people were there. They were exchanging ideas, he says. It's definitely plausible. What has researchers most excited, though, is how the finds are helping to change ideas about the people driving the transocean trade. Take the Buddha statue. Shipping the marble and the specialist stone cutters required to work on it from Alexandria to this remote desert port would have been a major undertaking. It's definitely a high-status dedication, Bondari says. Whoever commissioned the statue must have been wealthy, presumably a ship owner or merchant, and was keen to display that wealth. Similarly, the Sanskrit inscription was carved by an accomplished Indian scribe, and the donor took pains to point out his high class. In other words, the Indian visitors to Berenike weren't simply hired hands on Roman ships, but wealthy, influential players in their own right, agents, merchants, and ship owners who contributed to the community and stayed for significant periods of time, if not for good. Strauch's work on the Socotra inscriptions showed that hundreds of Indian travelers stopped over on the island, and they came from multiple levels of Indian society, including Kshatriyas, warriors and rulers, Vaishyas, farmers and merchants. By contrast, there are no Latin inscriptions and only two in Greek. Such finds make clear that it's no longer possible to think of the transocean trade as a Roman endeavor. By the 1st century AD, Strauch says, India was one of the main powers in these transcontinental trade routes. Profits from this trade were extremely important for the success of all three ruling dynasties, Strauch says, and for the growth of Buddhism, which they supported. In fact, he suggests it may have been the Indians, not the Romans, who instigated and drove Indian Ocean trade. I think the Indians were the main agents. Cobb says that the traditional view that Romans primarily built and sailed the ships, reaping the riches they found in exotic lands, has fallen to the wayside. A shift in historical understanding that has been hammered home by the accumulating finds at Berenike and Socotra. This shift is also reframing our view of Western impacts on India, where Greeks began to settle after Alexander's conquests. Indo-Greek kings of the 2nd century BC famously blended Greek and Indian languages, symbols, and beliefs. But these influences are seen as examples of Western colonizers imposing their culture and dominating other lands. For Strauch, Bondari, and others, the importance of the Berenike finds is to refocus the lens, drawing attention to the Indian merchants, ship captains, and sailors who carried their own culture across the ocean, and the role they played in shaping the Western world. The colonial tradition says that people only came here. We never go there, says Charian, the archaeologist in Kerala. But it was two-way. Late one afternoon, as the sun dips towards the mountains, Siddhabotham takes a walk on the beach, where the sand is strewn with traces of modern ocean trade, water bottles and Pepsi cans and shredded plastic bags. On the way, he passes a small Egyptian temple by the old harbor. It was used during Berenike's final phase in the 4th and 5th centuries after the Roman Empire had begun to weaken. At the time, the temple may have stood on a little island surrounded by the sea. All that's visible now is a rectangular mound of coral fragments. When the team excavated, it must have felt as if the worshippers had only just left. Inside were stone benches and mats made from tamarisk twigs, an altar and a heap of cowrie shells apparently once strung up in a curtain across the door. Ritual items included a bronze bull's head, carefully placed lotus seeds, a terracotta jar containing 50 crescents of silver, and broken bowls still holding the bones from portions of mutton stew. From this later period, Siddhabotham's team still finds ceramics and other goods from across the ocean, including from India. And a few years ago, in the northern complex, They found two inscriptions from the 4th or 5th centuries, dedicated not to Roman emperors, but Blemian kings. The Blemies were semi-nomadic tribes indigenous to the eastern desert. The Romans described them as wild, headless barbarians with faces on their chests. But it appears that after the 3rd century, Roman officials no longer controlled this gateway to the east. Trade continued, but the locals were effectively in charge. As Christianity spread through Egypt, becoming the official religion of the Roman Empire in the 4th century, the Watery Temple was one of the last outposts of the old faith. The Blemies resisted conversion and continued to worship Isis here into the 6th century. As Caper puts it, this is where the Egyptian religion dies out. The last literary reference to Berenike describes an event from around AD 525. Then it disappears from history, as traders found safer, more profitable routes. A few years later, bubonic plague swept up the Red Sea coast. Maybe that is what caused the fading port finally to be abandoned, says Sitobotham. The Blemies returned to the desert, and Berenike returned to the sand. 3 decades after Sitobotham first set foot in this remote bay, the secrets unearthed have proved beyond expectations, he says. Flies drive you crazy. The toilets are awful. But this is my life right here. This is what I live for. And he has no plans to stop. With only 2% or so of the site excavated so far, he wonders, could the sand be hiding treasures? Silk, ceramics, even statues from China 5,000 miles away? It would mean the ship swept by the monsoons into the once vibrant harbor, rivaled the caravans of the Silk Road, not only in cash terms, but in distance too, propelling trade networks stretching to the great Han Dynasty and the very edge of the known world. I think it's probably here, he says. We just haven't found it yet. Next, we'll move on to an article from the prologue section, titled One for the Books by Andrea Mays and James L. Swanson. A full 82 copies of Shakespeare's first folio will go on view as the renovated Folger Library makes its debut. Future titan of industry Henry Clay Folger Jr. lived the first part of his life in Dickensian poverty. Born in Brooklyn in 1857, he used essay contents to pay for his education at Amherst College, where he hand-washed his own laundry to save money and still could not afford coal for heat. And he was a deep admirer of William Shakespeare. He recalled delight in reading the bard's plays and poems far into the night while still at Amherst. A guest lecture by 75-year-old Ralph Waldo Emerson inspired Folger to search out the author's 1864 remarks at the celebration of the 300th anniversary of the birth of Shakespeare, further inflaming his passion. Still, little about his early life indicated Folger would amass the largest collection of Shakespeareana in the world, the Folger Shakespeare Library, which has been the envy of other collectors and a lifeline to generations of Shakespeare scholars. Of all the collection's treasures, the central jewels are the first folios, the earliest published collection of the plays from 1623, of which only some 235 survive in any form. Now, as the Washington, D.C. Library reopens after an ambitious renovation and expansion, it's bringing its first folios out of the vault and onto display. The gathering of the 82 first folios is a historic moment, and the library's new exhibitions give visitors a variety of ways, both digital and analog, to know the bard better. The renovated Folger is a triumph, one that preserves and honors the best of its past while incorporating breathtaking updates and innovations. Folger was always a collector of sorts. He saved every book he ever read, and from childhood assembled meticulous scrapbooks of theater tickets and other ephemera, but he never owned a rare book. A chance encounter changed all that. One day in 1889, Folger wandered into New York City auction gallery and made an impulse purchase he could ill afford for $107.50, around $3,650 today. He bought a later 1685 edition of Shakespeare's plays, also known as the Fourth Folio. It included 7 new plays, 6 of them by other authors. Folger asked if he could pay in installments. He brought the volume home to his wife, Emily, who shared his literary inclinations. They opened the binding and beheld the portrait of the author, pressed from a copper engraving of the only known portrait of Shakespeare. They turned the thick, luxurious rag paper pages, poring over the beloved words. Henry Folger never recorded what called him into that first auction gallery on that decisive 1889 day. Little could he know that answering that mysterious call set him on the path to become the greatest Shakespeare collector in the world, nor that the young man who could barely afford $100 for a fourth folio would one day pay the highest price in the world for a book, not once, but three times, nor that he would create the greatest Shakespeare library on the planet. In any case, in 1893, Folger bought his first copy of a first folio and never looked back. Henry and Emily Folger purchased massive quantities of Shakespeare material that they ran out of space in their modest rented home. Folger safeguarded the most precious treasures in bank vaults and crammed the rest into hundreds of crates that he secreted in storage units scattered all over New York City. As the couple branched out into collecting other rare books, plus paintings and sheet music, the storage question became more pressing still. To preserve their collection in perpetuity, the Folgers decided to build a library in Washington, D.C., within sight of the U.S. Capitol, and gift their collection to the American people and as a triumph of industry and philanthropy. When the Folger Memorial Shakespeare Library was dedicated on April 12, 1932, the 368th anniversary of Shakespeare's birth, the Washington Post reported it was attended by a distinguished audience as ever gathered in Washington for any cultural reason. Sadly, Henry Folger died in 1930 and never got to see the completed monument to his and Emily's greatest passion. By the early 2000s, it had become obvious that the library had outgrown its home and was in desperate need of more space for its ever-expanding acquisitions of books, documents, playbills, manuscripts, paintings, artifacts, tapestries, costumes, sheet music, maps, musical instruments, and more. But the historic status of the original structure made it impossible to break through the roof and rise vertically, nor was it possible to expand the building's footprint. That left one option: dig deep below and build a new 12,000-square-foot wing, which includes 6,000 square feet of new exhibit space underneath the library and lawn. Much of the original structure remains intact. The huge reading room preserves its Elizabethan and Tudor-carved woodwork, its balcony and the dominant Seven Ages of Man stained glass window. The Jewel Box Theater lives on as an homage to the Elizabethan playhouse. The secluded founder's room that the Folgers designed for their own private enjoyment endures, and Henry and Emily Folger's ashes are entombed in a niche in the old reading room. And now, it's the first time that many first folios have been assembled in one place for years. So what would Henry Folger say today, knowing that his reinvented library has flung open to the world the doors to his treasures? Quoting Cardinal Wolsey in The Life of King Henry VIII, Folger would likely speak the words he ordered carved into stone above the entrance to his library. I shower a welcome on ye, welcome all. This article was cut for time. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is written with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.